leaders, informed people with strong opinions, could sit around and differ without dipping into ad hominem attacks, without being uncivil toward each other, without the underlying idea that if you disagree with me, you must be an idiot, or you must be a bad person, or you must have ridiculous or unworthy motivations for holding that point of view. I mean, that's what it's like across the spectrum in cable TV and on talk radio and in many websites. It isn't just, I think you're wrong, but the reason you're wrong is that you're a bad person or that you have an unworthy motivation for holding that opinion. This is not the kind of atmosphere that produces productive, thoughtful, or nuanced dialogue. And so no sooner had the sports reporters concluded and they had all delivered their little odes to what the show represented and how much fun it was to do, and Mitch Albom was on, and Bob Ryan and Mike Lupica, people who had been regulars on the show over the years, and they all made essentially the same point. It was a place to have spirited conversation that wasn't mean-spirited. And they dipped to black, and without a commercial, 10 seconds later, Stephen A. Smith, who is not without talent, was uttering the following line. I'll tell you why only a fool thinks that Kevin Durant... What? What? How did we go from point A to point B without ever hitting the brakes or without ever considering what direction the bus was headed?
Hey,
so that would be something I'd talk about.
But part of
I think I just wrote the whole chapter for you, right?
You
there.
Did. That's very good. I hope we were recording that. We got it all transcribed for you. Part of the book has to be this, though. I don't know if you've told the story in years, but I can remember hearing it. Maybe it was on Acosta's Coast to Coast program. But part of your affection for our town was you being in New York with your dad in a car and listening to Cardinal baseball.
Yeah, those are the sorts of stories I would definitely tell. The personal stories that impact the career that I had and the way I look at sports, things that everyone can relate to. I'm not a particular fan, no matter who it's about, of people thinking that revealing every last tidbit about their life should be fascinating to other people. I just find that odd and in some cases kind of vulgar in the biggest sense of vulgarity, not profanity or stuff that's off color. I just find it vulgar that people think that every last detail of their life should be interesting to anybody. That's sort of more self-absorbed than I would like to be. But the story you're talking about, I think people can relate to, and it's this. My dad, in addition to being a very, very colorful and interesting and funny and charismatic guy, who died when he was only 42. In fact, he died 47 years ago yesterday, so he's been gone 5 years longer than he lived. My dad was an inveterate gambler, which led to some anxiety, because after all, when the mortgage is riding on whether Wilt Chamberlain can make two free throws, or Whitey Ford can get Al Kaline out with the bases loaded, that provokes a little bit of nervousness in the house. But it also led to a lot of comical moments and colorful moments. And I crossed paths with guys that may have had somewhat shady backgrounds, because that's the sort of people who operate in the bookmaking business. And so what my dad would do in the 1960s, this is way before ESPN, this is obviously way before the internet or cable TV. And so other than the Yankees or the Mets, who were on the air on Long Island where we lived, if he was going to follow a bet on a game between Cincinnati and St. Louis, the only way you had any chance of picking up the game was for him to give me the keys to the car and for me to sit in the driveway where radio reception would certainly be better than in the house. And I would turn the car on at 10 or 11 years old. It would remain in park. I didn't drive around the neighborhood. But I would calibrate the dial on the radio as carefully as a safecracker, trying to find 3WE in Cleveland for the Indians, or WLW in Cincinnati for the Reds. And on a crystal clear night, you might get through the crackle and static KMOX in St. Louis and hear Harry Carey and Jack Buck describe the Cardinal game. And then I would run back into the house, and with a flourish of the tail, the young play-by-play man or budding play-by-play man would relate to my father what had happened. But if his bet was losing, I would tell him I couldn't pick the game up because I didn't want to deal with his shifting moods. But if he was winning, it'd be like, okay, Buček moved a single to right. White doubled off the screen. Buček stopped at third. Musial came up, hit a sharp single to right. They both scored. 2-0 Cardinals, bottom of the fourth.
Oh, that is great. All right, so you're not retiring at all. You're scaling back. And you're in a profession, though, where guys just don't retire. It's like Vern Lundquist, 76, finally stepping back a little. Vin was 89. Brent was 77. Enberg, 82. Al Michaels, 72. But you're at a point where you just want to kind of pick and choose and scale back, correct?
Right. I'll still do a lot of baseball. In fact, probably more baseball than I have done in the past few years. Now, is it as widely seen as the games that Joe Buck does on Fox or postseason games? No, it's the MLB Network. It's kind of a niche thing, but I enjoy doing those games. And I would look for a place, I'm not exactly sure where it will be, and I'm not in a rush, but I would look for a place to replicate the kind of long-form interviews that I used to do in late night on NBC, either in or out of sports, and the kind of commentary and sports journalism that I did at HBO. I'd look for a place where you have the breathing room to do justice to that kind of work and those kind of subjects. That's what I really want to do. I had gotten to a point, and people find this, I guess, hard to believe, not just about me, but about anybody. I'd long since stopped caring that the two things that I walked away from, the Olympics and Sunday Night Football, are actually the two largest audiences, not just in all of sports, but maybe, when you think about it, on a consistent basis in all of television. That didn't matter as much to me as whether or not I was deeply engaged in it. And I'll always be grateful to NBC and the Olympics for the role that they played in my career. But there was a certain tightening of the formats over time. It was different over the last half dozen or so Olympics than it was over the first five or six that I did, where there was a little more leeway for the host, not to opine, not to get in the way of the action, but to frame the action, to frame what's happening, to provide a little perspective, to provide an observation, and to not be so tightly formatted that you're just a traffic cop. Being a traffic cop is an important part of being the Olympic host, and you have to be good at it. But I would come to each Olympics with a good deal of interesting and, I think, pertinent information, and I got to use maybe 2% of it. And, hey, it's their show to run, and they run it well on its own terms. But I didn't feel as if I did a 13th Olympics, a 14th, or a 15th, that it would increase my lifetime batting average any. They were kind enough to let me decide if I'd wanted to continue on both of those programs. I could have continued. But I let them know, actually, years ago. We just kept it a secret because I didn't want to call any undue attention to it while I was still doing it. But they've known for years that I intended to step away from both when my present contract ran out, which is why they wisely went out and hired Mike Tirico, who's so versatile and able to fill a number of those roles. And then they gave me an ongoing role at NBC, which they tabbed the Brokaw clause. So roughly speaking, although I don't compare myself in stature or accomplishment, roughly speaking, I will be to sports in the years ahead what Tom Brokaw is now to news. He doesn't do any regular program, but when something of some consequence occurs where his experience and insight and perspective would be worthwhile, then Tom Brokaw pops up on NBC News. And it'll be the same with me in sports.
It's impossible to try to come up with your biggest thrills in broadcasting, but there's a couple of fun ones. Since it was Derek Jeter Day on Sunday in Yankee Stadium, let's go back to September 2014, and your voice here sounds so youthful and energized. It almost sounded like you were doing a Freddie Lewis jump shot for the Spirits of St. Louis. Take a listen. Where does that one rank for you?
Oh, I guess it's somewhere on the list. You know what my disappointment is about that one? And it was a wonderful moment. Jeter hit the first pitch. And for the moment, I actually forget the name of Baltimore's pitcher. But part of a good play-by-play man's job isn't just to call the play. It's to frame what's going on leading up to it and after it. And I needed one pitch, a foul ball, a pitch taken, in order to say, this is the nature of baseball. standing at the plate, one of the bold-faced names of his generation and in all of baseball history. Perhaps his last at-bat in this ballpark. And standing 60 feet 6 inches from him is a man whose name has never appeared in anything bolder than Agate type, a virtual unknown, and they may be connected historically depending upon what happens in the next few moments. Derek Jeter, who's always had a flair for the dramatic, has a chance to bring the curtain down in as dramatic a fashion as possible. The stage is set. Let's see what happens. I just needed one pitch for that to happen. But the damn guy hit the first pitch. You think you're more considerate of me.
Yeah, it's not like Reggie Jackson, who at Tiger Stadium one time paused and hesitated so you could replay the home run. Tell that one.
Reggie Jackson certainly understood the power of the spotlight, and he wanted to be in it. And so Tony Kubek and I are doing the old Saturday afternoon baseball game of the week, and I think it's 1983, and he's playing for the Angels. And they're playing the Tigers at Tiger Stadium, the old Tiger Stadium. And Reggie hits one over the right field roof. His most famous home run, other than the ones he hit in the World Series, was the one he hit in the All-Star game, I think in 1971, off Doc Ellis, that hit the light transformer on top of the roof at right center. And that was one of the hardest hit balls anyone has ever seen and might have traveled over 500 feet had it not hit the transformer. This one wasn't hit quite that hard, but it did clear the entire roof, the third deck of the roof, and it landed in the lumber yard across the street. So he rightly assumed that Kubek and I were giving plenty of coverage to that and talking about how far it might have gone and et cetera, et cetera. So the old broadcast booth at Tiger Stadium was so close to the field that Ernie Harwell, the beloved voice of the Tigers, often said that if the crowd was quiet, you could hear conversations at home plate between innings. So Reggie was scheduled to be the leadoff man the next time he came to bat, who was going to start the inning. And during the commercial, he's in the on-deck circle. And I hear this piercing whistle, the kind of whistle I've always wished I could do, but I can't. You know, the kind that could be heard a half a mile away. And the piercing whistle comes from the on-deck circle. And I look down, and he's pantomiming tying his shoes. And I kind of shake my head at him and look at him quizzically. And he pantomimes tying his shoes again and then gives that sign that anyone who's worked in television knows, where you start with your hands together and then you stretch them out, which means, you know, stretch. We need to fill some time. So now I nod to him and I get what he's saying. He wants to give me enough time to allow the audience to fully revel yet again in the home run he hit. So he walks to the plate, he gets in the box, he digs a hole and, you know, kicks at the dirt, and then just before the pitcher winds up, he asks for time, and he steps out. So now I know all this is coming, so I tell a producer, you can replay the home run, we replay the home run, we talk about it, Reggie gets back into the box, he glances up at me and Kubek, all right, he nods, I nod at him, and then he singles up the middle, and he gets to first base. Now, why would anyone, especially in 83 when people didn't do this, even Reggie, he's like at first base on the third inning of a game, and he looks up at me, and he tips his cap. Like, okay, we've partnered on this moment. All hail Reggie.
By the way, the pitcher on the Jeter hit was Evan Meek, and you're right. He has not appeared in a game since.
So that could be the last pitch that he ever threw in the big leagues.
That's good stuff. All right, now I know you've interviewed some famous people and had some really important moments, but this little give and take with Ichiro I thought was classic. Take a listen.
What is your favorite American expression?
In August, in Kansas City, it's harder than two rats in a sock.
Yeah, you got a kick out of it, and so did the audience.
Well, here was the deal. I think it was 2003, and it was on HBO. And at that time, Ichiro had already made a splash, Rookie of the Year and MVP in the same season, you know, soaring batting averages. And he was such an appealing player because this is during the steroid era, and every game is 9-8, and it's bludgeon ball. And he's playing a type of ball that Ty Cobb would have understood, scampering around, stealing bases, little line drives, infield hits, terrific fielder. Just the whole way he played the game was deeply appealing. So in any case, he had not done an English language interview with anybody. The Japanese press followed him everywhere, and he had an interpreter for his interviews with the American press. There were dozens and dozens of Japanese writers and broadcasters who followed him because baseball fans in Japan were intensely interested in what he did. There had been quite a few Japanese pitchers who had played in the major leagues up until that time, but people will be surprised to learn that Ichiro was the first position player who came to the big leagues and stuck. Since then, there have been many more, but he came and came in with a bang. So he sits down with us for an interview, and the interpreter was a Japanese actor of some note, and he was very dramatic. Everything he said with a tremendous flourish. So if you said to Ichiro, "What is the thing you like least about American baseball?" he would give his answer, and he himself is a very thoughtful guy, and he understood the questions. He understood English better than he spoke it at that point, but he still relied on the interpreter. And the interpreter would then come back and say something like, "You know, I love my manager, Lou Piniella, and I admire my teammates like Brett Boone, but why would they break their bat or throw their cap? A craftsman must respect his tools. Take, for example, a chef. How could you create a delicious meal without the proper knives and forks and carving materials? It's not possible." And everything went on like this, you know? And so then I say to him, I'm thinking, well, he's been around long enough. If I say, "What's your favorite American expression?" he's probably picked something up. Maybe it'd be like, "What up, dog?" or whatever people said at that time. So I say to him, "Ichiro, what's your favorite American expression?" And he pauses. He goes, "Hmm." And he nods his head, and that was the only time he bypassed the interpreter. And in English, he said, "August in the Kansas City, it's hotter than two rats sleeping in a wool sock." Except it was HBO, and we didn't have to bleep it. So now I'm cracking up. The crew is cracking up. And Ichiro is looking around the room with an expression of satisfaction and hilarity. He's half laughing and half, like, nodding, like, "Didn't I just get off a good one here?" And then I have to explain to him afterwards, "You know, Ichiro, there is no such expression as that. That expression does not exist, and your teammates are playing you. Your teammates are like getting you to say ridiculous things. They're using you like you're some kind of comedic prop." And I can just imagine what other situations he unknowingly wandered into because his teammates said, "Hey, you see that person over there? Why don't you just say," and maybe he did it. I don't know.
Part of the book, if there is a book, a chapter will have to be on the spirits.
You're pushing this book. It's not available at Barnes & Noble. And will not be for a long time.
But the spirits brought you here. What an incredible experience with the characters involved, and many of them with really sad endings, including the story last week where Fly Williams was arrested and labeled a drug kingpin in the Brooklyn area selling heroin. I'm wondering how you do remember Fly Williams.
Well, it's a very sad, if not ending, yet another chapter. He was a guy from the streets. He was a street ball legend, a playground legend in New York. And he had played briefly at Austin Tee in Tennessee, where, I don't know if I should say this or not, but what the heck.
Go ahead.
When he was there, and I think he left after his sophomore year, but when he was their star player, the chant in the student section at Austin Tee was, "The fly is open, let's go pee." So that was their chant. I've descended many rungs on the ladder. My career is over. But in any case, when he came to the spirits, his playing time was limited because he couldn't be counted upon to execute whatever play was called or to fit into the flow. He was just Fly, you know. And yet he was beloved by the small group of Spirits fans who would turn out 2,500 or however many were at the arena on an average night. They loved him because he played with such exuberance. And the first night of the Spirits, if I recall this correctly, against Memphis in October of 1974, before, the first night he came off the bench and scored like 24 points, and he was just electric. But his game was just too crazy for him to ever make it in the pros. And then on top of that, he was obviously into situations that, like Marvin Barnes, that undermined his talent and demolished his career.
A couple of current thoughts before we let you go. You're on the broadcast tonight with Jim Cott on the MLB Network. I don't know how closely you've been following the Cardinals, but it's certainly been surprising. We thought this was going to be a Cubs year, maybe even a Cubs decade. Your impressions of the 2017 Cardinals so far?
Well, I think they're certainly poised to contend. I was at a gathering with Whitey Herzog yesterday, and he said, you know, we won the pennant in 1985, and then in 86, the Mets beat us by like 20-some games. And in 87, Dick Young, who was then a legendary writer, baseball writer in New York, has since passed away, but Dick Young asked Whitey at spring training, how are you going to make up those 20-plus games? And Whitey said, hey, I just checked the standings in spring training. We're even. And they wound up beating the Mets in a fine pennant race that year by three games or four games or whatever. Each year is different. The Cubs are built to last. Last year was not a lightning in a bottle situation. They have as many, they and the Red Sox have as many good young position players as any team in baseball. But they won 103 last year and everything came together. You can't expect that to happen again. I think probably anywhere from 92 to 95 victories wins the National League Central. The Cubs are a game under 500 now, but they're certainly capable of reeling off 18 wins in their next 24 games the way the Cardinals just have. They're certainly capable of doing that. It's a long, long season, and I wouldn't count the Cubs out from winning the division. But the way things are shaped up now for the Cardinals, you look at the potential wild card contenders. A lot of people thought, well, the Nationals are great, but the Mets with their pitching and with Cespedes supposedly healthy for a full year, the Mets are likely to grab a wild card. Well, the Mets have been decimated by injuries, and they don't look like a team that's likely to contend. The Giants, who have always been in the mix for either the division or a wild card, they've been decimated too. So if the Cardinals don't wind up in first place in the Central, barring catastrophe, there's two wild card spots, and I certainly see them grabbing one of them.
Great stuff. Bob, honored to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being a part of it. We'll be watching tonight on the MLB Network with you and Jim Cott. Thank you so much.
These were epic answers that I provided. I'm now coming up for air.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, see you. Bye.
It's our honor to welcome to the program the great Ken Hitchcock. Ken, Coach, great to be with you. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Frank. How are you doing?
Very good. Great to hear your voice. I got to tell you, I don't mean to start with just effusive praise, but soundbite-wise, interviewing you, it was like cheating. You have the gift of gab, and every reporter in St. Louis is thankful for your great service to filling our shows and our newspaper columns.
Frank, I got to tell you, I learned that lesson a long time ago, doing it the wrong way, and I had a guy that I really respected that told me, when I got into this league, I better wake up and educate people because the way I was doing it was not right. And that was back in 1996, and I learned, and I've kind of had that attitude that part of my job is to make your guys' job easy as I can, and that's a big part of it, not make it more difficult like I did when I first started.
So you were a tough interview early? I can't imagine that.
Frank, I was really defensive interview. I was really, I was a guy that, you know, felt like anything I gave, I was leaking out information, and it took a guy, my general manager, sitting me down and saying, "This isn't like Canada. You have an obligation to help and educate people, and every time you do what you just did, you're setting the game back." And it was a big wake-up call for me, and I changed. And I think part of my job is to make your guys' job as easy and as informative as possible, and so I take pride in doing that.
So you're still in St. Louis for a little longer, and I understand you got together with Ben Bishop, and that probably helped facilitate the deal. Did you needed to see Ben and talk to him a little bit first?
You know what? We talked all the time during during the optional skates before training camp, because Ben was in the auxiliary room down at the mills, and so his stall was 20 feet from me every day. So we would sit and talk kind of two or three, four times a week, just about what was going on in Tampa and stuff like that. And so I got to know Ben when he was training with the other Blues players and the other pros that were here. And we hit it off. I like him. He's kind of a Midwest guy, and you know, so we developed almost a friendship well ahead of before he was playing. And then obviously when Ben's name came up, I was really supportive of him.
And did you actually meet with him in St. Louis recently?
We've talked two or three times on the phone, and I'm back in St. Louis now, just getting ready to move, and we're going to have coffee this week before I get out of here.
Boy, you're a lot of times when you take over a team that didn't make the playoffs, you're taking over a team with not a whole lot of talent. You're going to a Dallas team that you're very familiar with Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin and Jason Spezza. You have some players. I mean, you guys believe you can play and be in contention right away, correct?
Well, I think there's a difference, Frank, between winning and playing winning hockey. And when I see these teams in the Central Division, Blues included, there's so many teams that play winning hockey in this division. You know, you got Nashville in the conference final. The Blues were in the conference final the year before. You've got so many teams that play winning hockey. Chicago, their record is incredible. There's a big difference between winning hockey games and playing a winning style. And I think in Dallas, we have to get back to playing a winning style of hockey so that we can win long term. And I think I spent a lot of time in the last month watching the teams in the Central Division play. And, you know, we have a challenge in front of us. We've got some really good pieces to work with, but we have to get back and play that style that's going to give yourself a chance to win every night on a consistent basis.
The day it was announced that you were not going to be the head coach of the Blues, did you know that day that you were going to coach again?
No, I didn't. It wasn't. It was almost 2 months before I started to turn my thoughts that way. I said this in the press conference in Dallas. I don't know if I would have coached again if I hadn't started getting all those calls from coaches. And that's what really got me revved up again, was helping other coaches fix their issues. And I really got into it. I probably had 12, 15 guys calling me from various leagues, and I was watching games, sneaking into arenas. I was having a lot of fun trying to help other friends that, you know, some of them were in trouble in their own jobs, and some of them needed technical help. It was all over the place, and I really liked doing that. And then after doing that for about a month, I got really revved up about teaching and coaching again. And, you know, it's in my blood, and the teaching part's in my blood more than wins and losses come and go. Getting hired, getting fired comes and go. But, man, that once that teaching's in your blood, you don't want to ever let it go. And I really got rejuvenated, and I really was excited when the Stars called.
We're talking with Ken Hitchcock, Hollywood Casino Press Box on the all-new 590 The Fan. I believe your first year as a head coach was 1996. Now at age 65, do you think you have any less energy or less passion?
Less passion? No. Probably more passion. Energy-wise, you've got to be really smart when you're an older coach. You've got to really take care of yourself. You've got to really, got to use other people. And I think when we first start in this game and we're in our 40s, we feel like we can do it all ourselves. And I've learned over time that there's so much work in being a head coach in any of the four major sports that you need great people around you. And I really go out of my way to hire people who help me change my mind. And I really want those people around, people that are going to really challenge me, because I think as you get older, you realize that it has to be a shared responsibility. And I look for people who are really going to challenge me every day. And, you know, I had it for a long time in St. Louis. Great staffs, great people, really smart hockey people. And I'm going to be looking for the same thing in Dallas.
Coach, if I were to get divorced from my wife, I may like respect her and like her a lot, but I wouldn't want her to end up with George Clooney and have incredible happiness right away and see pictures of her on Twitter in Paris, okay? So it's human nature that after there's a breakup, you don't want enormous success for the person that you've broken up with. What was it like for you during that stretch when you saw the Blues play better?
For me, I don't even look at it that way. I had moved on. I learned a long time ago that you can't, if you want to be a coach, you can't look in the, you can't have a rearview mirror. And I don't have a rearview mirror. I move on very quickly. And I as a coach, you have to look at the big picture. And the big picture is that I had an unbelievable group of people to work with here. I enjoyed every minute of it, and I had to move on quickly mentally, and I did that. I really enjoyed my time here. I had a great group of people to work with. We had a lot of success, but there were other people that needed my help right away, and I got focused on that. I didn't spend much time watching the Blues play at all, to be honest with you, until I got hired in Dallas, and then I started working, looking at the Blues and all the other Central Division teams very closely. But I just, the rearview mirror part of it is really important. You've got to move on quick, and I've learned to do that.
I know you and Doug have been close. How would you describe your relationship now? Do you talk much?
We'll be close forever. You know, it's a... this is a lot bigger than the St. Louis Blues. This is a friendship. Doug was my boss in 1993. He was responsible for the farm team in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And we go back over 20 years, almost 25 years approaching. So it's a lot deeper than just our time together in St. Louis, way deeper than that.
Are you a believer in the Pat Riley theory that no matter how good or how successful you are as a coach, that eventually the message does get tired and there does have to be a transition? What do you think of that theory?
I don't believe it, but I do believe this, that I just watched a program on the English Premier League in soccer, and most coaches there last 3 years, and they're elite coaches, the best in the world. They last 3 years on most teams. That's the nature of the sport right now. In the National Hockey League, if you've lasted 5 years, you've done an unreal job, because that's just the way it is. It's not the message that gets tired. It's a lot of other issues that go on inside the locker room, and the coach is usually the last one to know, and you better get used to being in that business. But as difficult and challenging it is in North America, it's twice as hard in Europe in those sports there. And that's just the nature of the game. And if you've done a good job at our level and you get to coach on the same team for 5 years, that's really successful.
What do you think of the coach in waiting idea in general, philosophically?
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great idea. And I think it's something that us veteran coaches I don't think it has to be a coach in waiting so much, but if you have a guy that has the courage to challenge you on a daily basis and help you change your mind when you need changing, I think it makes you better as a coach.
Boy, it makes for an awfully intriguing division. I mean, if you have Nashville in the Western Conference Final, you have Chicago with those three Stanley Cups, you have a very good Minnesota team. Now your Dallas team and the Blues. What an incredible division this is going to be, Coach.
Frank, you haven't even included Winnipeg.
You're right.
Winnipeg's got the most skill and talent across the board of anybody. And if they start to play winning hockey on a consistent basis, there's the potential, to be honest with you, there's the potential for 500-point teams in this division, which is incredible. That's how tough this division is going to be. And, you know, it's exciting. The winners in this are the fans. Every time a Central Division team plays each other next year, it's going to be like a single elimination playoff game. It's going to be a lot of fun.
So, again, you kind of touched on that earlier in the interview, but you really were not paying too close of attention to the St. Louis Blues, maybe in the playoffs, but in the regular season, you kind of, that's it. I'm not going to really watch that much.
No, I didn't. And in fairness, and a lot of it was because other coaches from other programs were calling, and I was traveling. I was going out and seeing the teams play. I was watching it on video. I was having a lot of fun. There's no other way to describe it. I was having a lot of fun. I was really enjoying myself, and I hope I helped some people. They told me I did. But I was having a lot of fun, and I only got spotted in one rink, Frank. I made it into eight or nine rinks, and nobody saw me or knew who I was, and I only got identified in one arena, which is pretty good.
A few more thoughts before we let you go. I think our listening audience that don't know this story, your dad is the one who cultivated your love for the game. Can you elaborate on that?
My father was a coach, and my father was responsible for my dad coached in the program that ultimately fed the Detroit Red Wings. So my dad coached the third. It would be like a single A in baseball. And my dad coached the single A program that fed the Detroit Red Wings. So it went Junior B Red Wings, Edmonton Oil Kings, Edmonton Flyers, Detroit Red Wings. And my dad coached a lot of younger players that were 15, 16, and 17. So I was going to hockey practices with my dad when I was 4 years old and watch him run practices. And quite frankly, some of them were even outdoors, but that's my first recollection at watching a coach operate.
I imagine your dad would be pretty proud knowing that you're still coaching the NHL at 65.
I hope he would be, because he was my hero.
Coach, honored to have you on the program. Thanks so much. We wish you nothing but success in Dallas. Thanks for everything you've done in St. Louis.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Our next guest is such a prima donna that he demanded that his favorite song be played. Let's take a listen here for a second before it gets dirty. Bring it up loud.
One moment that you capture, just let it slip. Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already.
All right. That is Lose Yourself by Eminem. It's our pleasure to welcome one of my all-time favorites as we celebrate about 25 years of radio. I told Brian, let's just make this a week of great talkers, great guys. Nobody better than Tioka Jackson. How are you, sir?
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Everything's great. What's going on in your world?
Hey, man, the same old, same old. I'm just trying to figure out why I'm getting called a prima donna. You feeling yourself on this 25th anniversary, aren't you? Look at you. You feeling all good about yourself and dropping little bombs on your friends. See how that works?
I got a cup of water next to me. I don't know whether to drink it or to walk on it.
You know what, though? You deserve it, man. 25 years is a long time to be in radio, to stay relevant. People listen to you. You always one of my favorites because you kept it respectful at all times, even though you might have asked tough questions or wanted some inside info that I didn't want to give up or anything like that. But you always kept it respectful, and for that, I always respected you.
Well, thank you. You know, we hear stories about athletes, especially I think it's NFL and NBA players, like right after retirement, having trouble either with their marriages, with their finances. You're the one of the exceptions to the rule. There's many of them, but just give our listening audience a little idea of how your life is spent nowadays: business, career, family, everything.
Well, I mean, I got a couple businesses, a couple restaurants, and we in real estate, and I'm in business with my family, my brother and my dad, and it was something we focused on early on in my career, and I think that's one of the things that my colleagues who don't have a successful transition don't do. They don't focus on the days they got to get out. That was something that I decided I needed to focus on. As an undrafted free agent, you better focus on it. And I think that's, again, one of the things. Guys come in who were drafted high and think the money's going to last forever, that they're going to last forever. It sounds silly now when you're 45 like me, but when you're 22, you know, forever doesn't seem like a mighty long time. And so you find out that it is, and so you need to prepare early. I got that message quickly when I went broke after my first year in the league. And I needed to get an advance from the Dolphins to get through the offseason. I said, I need to do something different or this won't work. And that's when I decided to change my mindset, saving and investing and creating a business, entrepreneurship. Those became my focus, and they still are my focus today.
So we know about your long career, which started in 94 and lasted till 2006. You had almost 200 tackles, played on that Super Bowl team. But was there a year in 95 where you actually didn't play?
Correct. Yeah, I was out of the league for 1 year, and I had to have a real serious self-assessment. I looked myself in the mirror and tried to decide what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And by then, I had already gotten cut twice, because to get put on a practice squad, you got to get cut. And I was cut from Atlanta's roster, put on a practice squad, and then Miami claimed me off the practice squad after 10 weeks and finished the season with them playing the playoffs. And then they cut me in the offseason of 95. And so I was like, you know, I got my degree. I can go on into the real world. I did it the right way at Penn State. I can just, you know, move on, because I'm in love with a game that doesn't seem to be in love with me. But after talking to my dad and mostly my brother, they encouraged me not to give up on it, to keep going. And that was some valuable information and valuable toolage I got from the older folks in my life, because I reeled off 11 straight years after that and changed my life forever.
Well, you got to be thinking, too, when you're not playing in 95, there's no way you're ending up with a 12-year NFL career.
No. At that point, I just wanted to get back in. I wanted a shot. You know, I wanted to get a shot to get back in. And so I was at home with my mom and dad in the basement that I grew up in, working out every day, running. I worked out for a few teams, Carolina, Pittsburgh, but they didn't want to sign me for whatever reason. And I just had to keep the belief in myself. And that's where you kind of learn who you are and what it takes to survive and what it takes to win. And you have to have an unwavering belief in yourself. And you should know that. I mean, I'm sure you were told no and had some things that didn't go your way in your broadcasting career and people that didn't believe in you. But you got to be realistic in your goals. And I had to have that conversation. Is this a pipe dream, playing in the NFL? Is this something I believe I could do? And every time I watched the film of myself, I thought I was trying to be as honest and as fair to myself as possible. I just felt like I looked like an NFL player. I was making plays that guys in the league weren't making, and I felt like if I didn't get in the right situation where a team needed someone and didn't care how tall you were and what the clock speed said you did, but just turned the film on and said, this guy can play for us. If I could find a team who believed in that sort of attitude, I'd have a chance. And that's I got lucky, and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers called and didn't have a head coach. Tried to find the tuna Parcells had just got done, and he said no. And they tried to give it to Jimmy Johnson. He said no. And they tried to give it to Spurrier. He said no. And they finally landed on some guy I'd never heard of named Tony Dungy, and it all worked out.
Not to get too nosy, but what about faith and prayer in all this? Were you praying for success, or to take me through that a little bit?
Well, to be honest with you, you know, I'm always honest. My mom and dad did all the praying. I did the working.
Okay.
And I have nothing against prayer, faith, and all those things. I really don't. But for me, I focused on doing what I had to do to get what I had to get. And I just felt like if I just could just work every day on what I wanted to accomplish and treat people properly and treat people the way they were supposed to be in all walks of life. And I had the backing of my mother and my father and my brother and my sister who stayed prayed up at all times. I felt like it would work. And that, to be honest with you, that's exactly how I went through it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let me get to the finances again, because I'm always amazed, especially when you hear some of these stories about guys that made so much money and then it's all gone by the time they're 26 or 27. You had an agent. Now, did you have a financial advisor and he said, or maybe you said, you had great discipline, this money is going in this bank and I'm not touching this? Or how did that work where you managed to put money away so you could buy these businesses later in life?
Well, I had both an agent and a financial advisor, but more importantly, once I went broke that one off season, the off season of 1995, before they cut me in the summer, I realized I was doing things wrong, and so I needed to change my habits. So I started to read more. I realized that no one's going to care more about my money than I do, even if it's someone I trust and love, dad, mom, agent, whomever. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, they have their own bank account to be more worried about than mine. So who should be more concerned about my money than me? So I started to read Money Magazine. I started to read Black Enterprise. I started to read all kinds of publications and learn about what's happening and where to put money, where smart people put their money, what smart people invest in. And that's when – but I always had an entrepreneurial passion along with my big brother. We always had that passion, so I had to learn a strategy on which how to invest and save to create the resources to start the business we wanted to start. And so we started in 95 with real estate, and we have yet to get out of that business because we believe in it, and we've learned and made mistakes and learned from our mistakes and profited from past mistakes and good decisions in the future or in the present. So going broke in that off season from March to August really taught me a lesson, and only a fool does not learn from mistakes like that.
And then in terms of the restaurants, how active are you? I'm not saying you're in the kitchen, but are you looking at the numbers every week now?
No, daily. The restaurant business is a hourly shiftly business, to be quite honest with you. It's all encompassing. If you really care about the business and you really want to win, weekly won't do it. I'm not big enough to look weekly. I've only got two stores, and so for me it's a daily process. We have and I'm in the store often, but not often enough to say I run it. But what we do have is an email system. We have what we call an EOD, an end of day report, that encompasses all of the shifts for each manager that worked that day, and all the numbers and a paragraph narrative of what happened. And so it's a daily review along with constant text message conversations. There isn't a day, Frank, that goes by that I don't communicate with at least one of my employees on our business. And so it's that serious for me because I care about the experience that our guests get when they walk in, and I care about my investment, and I care about the employees that we have given a job. We want them to have a job tomorrow. So we try to run it the right way. We make mistakes absolutely all the time, but we try to learn from every one of them.
What was it like? Okay, so you were broke in 95, and then you just had this nice career with Tampa and the Rams. Things are going well. And you only get, I think you get paid once a week in the NFL, once every 2 weeks or once a week?
Every 2 weeks.
When you got those paychecks, and you can tell us now what one of them was, just how crazy was that for you to hold that number in your hand?
It was insane, man. I mean, I never made a ton of money. I was a rare guy in NFL. I was a middle class guy. Middle class guys that lasted a long time. And middle class guys don't last a long time. They either transition to upper class or they transition out of the league. Generally, it's lower paid guys, the young players, and then it's a quick, brief visit, maybe for a year. In the middle class, and then you are either jumped up or you're out of the league. And so for me, I spent almost my entire career, I would say 8 of those 12 years were spent in the middle class, the last 8 of my career, 8 seasons of my career. And so that was, again, rare. In fact, it was the last 9 years. I was probably a low-paid guy for 3 years and then sort of middle class for the last 9. But those checks, which were, you know, about $50K after taxes every 2 weeks. Knowing that my dad, you know, was made probably that a year, and my mother did not make that a year, I was getting it every 2 weeks. It was ridiculous. It was crazy, and it really goes to show how young people can sort of get jaded by these checks. They're every 2 weeks, but they're only every 2 weeks during the season,
yeah.
Right? And so you need to figure out not only how I'm going to make this stretch throughout the all season, which shouldn't be hard if you're making any kind of real money, which they all are, and we all were in terms of even the lowest paid guys, but you got to figure out how to make that stretch beyond your career. And so I tell young people all the time, it's a rap song by the Lox. And it's old, so I know you probably heard of it, Frank, because it's from your day, man. I know you know the Lox. I know you know who Jadakiss is, all right? And there's a song called Money, Power, Respect, and my favorite line is, you better stack chips right now because you figure you're going to be older way longer than you're going to be younger, and that's the bottom line. NFL career for me, which is forever, 12 years, but I got the next 50 to figure out how I'm going to make that work. And so that's why saving and investing was always an important part.
All right. Now, you did that. You did all the smart things. But there had to have been at least one time when you're picking up one of these $50,000 checks and you said, what the hell? I'm going to go buy a really neat car.
Yes, there was
one. What'd you buy?
And again, I was a little different. So I didn't buy my first car until my seventh year in the league, believe it or not, my first brand new car. Every car before that was a used car. And so I, for my birthday, I wanted to buy myself a car. I was in Tampa at the time, and I went to the Mercedes dealership with the idea I was going to buy a used car. I was going to buy another used car like I had been doing. My first premium car I bought was a used Lexus LS450 from Trent Dilfer. He had bought it for his wife, and she didn't like it, and he was trying to unload it, and I stepped right in and bought that thing for a discounted price and was happy to do it. And so we wanted to do the same thing. And then one thing led to another, and I drive off the lot with a brand new Mercedes, SL500 Cabriolet thing. Listen, I felt like I deserved it. 7 years of trying to do the right thing. I splurged and paid cash, and it was ridiculous, but hey, I loved it.
Nice. Were you with the Rams when Incognito had that car where he had like 10 TV sets in the car?
I did not know. Hey, I was there when he was just a rookie, so he had not stepped out and done that yet. But that's crazy, man. No, I didn't even know he had that. 10 TVs, huh?
Oh yeah, and they said I never saw this specifically, but I swear someone told me that you could open up his gas tank and there was actually a monitor there.
No,
I don't know.
Hey, listen. I'm all for anyone who can afford to do what they want to do to do what they want to do. I'm not counting Incognito's money, and he made a ton of it, and I believe still making it. So, kudos to him. That just for me is a little much.
All right, I got to ask you too. We'll get into something serious here. In fact, Dick Bonacani is in your state of Florida. You've probably seen the stories. This horrible situation he's in right now. I want you to listen to his soundbite where he kind of describes his health.
My name is Nick Bonaconte. I'm in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I was a member of the 1972 undefeated Dolphins. Someone said I took 500,000 hits to my head. I can't remember how to tie a tie. I can't remember how to lace my shoes. My left arm won't do what my brain tells it to do. The answer would be no. I would not have played football.
When you hear about this, and you're a guy who played 12 years in the trenches, do you get concerned, or are you just simply sad for him? Or what are your emotions like when you hear stories like this?
Both. I'm sad for him and all the other my brethren who are going through what they're going through, and I'm scared as hell for myself. I don't live that every day, but when the conversation comes up, the fears come up. So it's I'm feeling it right now. I just because it's something I can't control, and then a lot of NFL players are like me, A-type personalities. We try to control every opportunity that we get, everything in our life. We're taught it in the game. with preparation, the practice, the repetitions, because you're trying to control how you're going to react in any given situation. Coaches put you in situations in practice that try to mimic what happens in a game. So a lot of all of we do is rehearse, and a lot of people try to figure out, well, how can you remember the plays and how can you do this? And in tough moments, we've practiced it so much since we were kids. And so having a controlled environment is what we're used to, even when it seems like it's not controlled. But this is not out of, in our control, Frank. And so this is scary, man. I don't know what's going on in my brain right now. I don't know if I got CTE. The gentleman who discovered it and coined the phrase CTE says that every NFL player, in his opinion, has it, because you can't get to that level without having played long enough to avoid it. So, you know, listen, I probably got it. Nothing I can do about it. I feel horrific about all the guys who have it. I hope I don't get it to where it takes over my life. But what I will always remember is the National Football League denied this existed. And we would be further along if two decades ago, when the players as a whole tried to get information, get access to statistics to start to attack this thing, who knows where we'd be. We might have a cure. We might have a way to diagnose it. We can't even diagnose it in the living right now, Frank, because this thing was pushed under the rug for so long. So we're woefully behind. It's finally getting funded. Kudos for them, to them for that. But you're late, and because of that, guys are suffering where maybe they wouldn't have to be.
Mm. I don't know this. I've seen pictures of you on Twitter, on your Facebook, with your daughter. Do you have a boy? Do you have a son at all?
Yeah, I do. I've got two daughters. I got a 21-year-old daughter and a 8-year-old daughter, and I have a 10-year-old boy.
Okay, let's say he comes to you in a couple of years and say, Dad, I want to start playing tackle football. Your reaction would be?
Right now he's playing flag, and I love it. And he won't play contact football. We're going to take a look at it when he gets to maybe a sophomore in high school and junior high school and see what it looks like. And if it looks like what it looks like now, I'm going to say, son, that's not the sport for you, because it could kill you. If somehow, some way, they find a way to diagnose and treat CTE, somehow, some way, the game has evolved to where there's only tackle on game day, then you got something. But, you know, my thought process is that no child should be playing tackle football. This is not soccer or baseball or golf, where you have to play the sport early in order to be really good. In football, if you are a good athlete and you can run and you have courage, you can play football. You can take the game up late because it's not as skill-driven. And we can practice route running. We can practice getting in your stance and getting out of your stance. We can practice hitting bags without full contact. So I would never, ever advise any young person be under the age of, say, 15 to practice or to take up tackle football, because it's unnecessary. I only played 2 years of Little League football, and you can't tell me that if I didn't play those 2 years, I wouldn't have played in the NFL. That's not true. There's nothing I took from those 2 years as a backup defensive lineman playing at 8 and 9 and 10 years old. There's nothing that carried from that through high school, through college, and through the NFL. So my answer to you, it's a very long answer to your question. My answer to my son is, if things are the way they are now and can progressively in a negative way, he won't be playing football.
Great to hear your voice. God bless you, sir. It's an honor to have you on the program. Well, the broadcasting career, where does that stand now?
Well, hey, this is the next dream I'm trying to work, man. I'm grinding on the lowest totem pole, and I'm thankful to be doing it with ESPN3. I get games during the college football season. I'm in great college towns, little towns, and also big towns like Vegas. But I'm also in Jonesboro, Arkansas from week to week. So I am grinding, trying to do my next dream, and I love talking football. My sport is certainly in peril right now. I just hope that we can get the medical research to alleviate the problems, because it's a great sport and it taught me a lot about life. And so hopefully I can continue the opportunity to be a part of it.
Thank you, my friend. We'll talk again.
And congratulations. Thank you, Frank.
All right, buddy. This is a special week for us as we kind of move into year 25, and we've had a chance to talk with Bob Costas and Ken Hitchcock and Konzo Martin and Norm Stewart. And, you know, I've done the interviews, but what I should have done is we should have brought in Roy Firestone, because he is the best interviewer of all time. Currently the host of Face to Face put on by HDNet. And for many of us, simply the host of one of the greatest programs, if you're about my age, you made sure it was appointment television up close on ESPN. If you were a great athlete and you were playing on the West Coast, you know what you'd do? You'd play a game, and then you'd sit in studio with Roy Firestone. In fact, it was really cool. Like, if St. Louis teams would go to the West Coast, we'd always wonder as young fans, hey, I wonder if Roy's going to ask one of the Cardinals to come in. Is he going to book a guy like Ozzie Smith? It's our pleasure to welcome to the program Roy Firestone. Roy, great to be with you. How are you?
Hey, Frank, congratulations on all these great years. I know that you, I don't know updated, but I know that you just moved to KSDK, I believe, if that's not inaccurate. I knew that, and I know that you've been doing a lot of things for a long, long time in CBS Radio, and of course, a great job, and thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it.
Well, let's chat. You're now over 5,000 interviews, and do you still have the same passion now as when you first started?
Oh, I think in some ways more so. I'm older. I'm more, hopefully more mature. I doubt that. But I think I've seen more in life anyway in the mix. And I think that's part of interviewing, is to observe life through the prism of the person you're talking to. Let them tell their story. But through your experiences in life and how you frame questions, I think you get a better exchange. I'll tell you one thing that I've really noticed. I think the tenor in America in interviewing, even in interviewing, forgetting about all the other nonsense that's on TV and radio and coming from all different walks of life, the tenor of interviewing has changed. People are more wary. People are less willing to be open in the same ways they were even 20 years ago. And I think part of it is because there's going to be a gotcha somewhere. I never really did a lot of gotcha questions, Frank, when I was a broadcaster for ESPN. I believed in letting people tell their stories, and with dignity and with hopefully some kind of hope and detail of why they got to where they are and their road. And I'm just generally disappointed in what's happening now and the whole tenor of America discourse. And by the way, not just politics, but sports too. We see it more and more, these kind of shock shows and anger shows. And I never, ever watched sports, Frank, with a clenched fist. I never watched sports like that. It was always joy and love. Now it seems like people are waiting for other people to fail or to trip up or say something stupid. And it's elevated and amplified. And I think we're poorer for it. I really do.
Let's go back to some of your great moments. We'll play a clip, and then you give me the backstory.
Sure.
First of all,
sure.
We'll go really far back, but it was so good. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube. The best hitter of all time, Roy Firestone with Ted Williams.
Oh, boy.
What's
okay.
A hero? To me, you're the Duke. You're the Duke of baseball. I know John Wayne.
No,
I know you met him once.
I don't feel that at all.
You don't feel you were the John Wayne of baseball?
You know why? I know how many bad things I've done. I'm ashamed of them. And no. I think that I did some pretty good things.
But what are you ashamed of? Tell me what you're ashamed of right now on television.
I can't tell you, Christ. I mean, I'll liable to throw you in jail.
How about that, Roy?
Well, if you're starting with the number one for me, the most unforgettable person I've ever interviewed in my life. He was, in fact, a John Wayne character. I do a lot of things for military families, wounded warriors, and things like that. And I always tell my story about Ted Williams. I'm going to make it super short for radio here. But basically, he was shot down. By the way, John Glenn, the great astronaut, great American, and senator, congressman, one of America's true heroes, was his wingman when he flew. They were best friends. And they were at a crash landing. They hit the runway in Korea at about 300 miles an hour. Everything's on fire. He's telling this story with so much detail, like it happened an hour ago. They almost hit a fence. The thing blows up. They roll out of the jet, the F-9, I think it was, and they survive. So I say to you, Ted, boy, you must have felt good. You were going home after that. He goes, what do you mean going home? I said, well, you know, you escaped death, and you're probably going to be discharged honorably. He goes, discharged honorably? Hell, I was back in the air the next day. And that's the way he was. He was that kind of person. He was Audie Murphy And he was also the best hitter who ever lived at the same, almost the same time. Larger than life, maybe my most unforgettable person I've ever met in any walk of life in America.
You got this out of Magic Johnson on some of his business acumen.
We were in Atlanta.
Okay.
We hadn't opened the Fridays yet. A woman stopped her car. We were out front. She said, "Young man, I've lived in this community for 40 years. For 40 years, I've never had a chance to have a salad. I had to go 30, 40 minutes just to get a salad. Well, now she can go 5 minutes to get a salad in her own community." And she hugged me and thanked me and said, "You know what? God's going to keep you." And that meant more to me than driving down the middle, passing, or anything, because now I've affected somebody's life.
How about that, Roy?
Wow. You know, a lot is said and written. We live in Los Angeles here about Irvin. There's a lot of things about him that are larger than life, but nothing larger than his heart. You know, everybody is perhaps worthy of criticism here and there. I find very little to criticize about this guy, and I'll tell you why. He walks in a room and makes people feel better about who they are. I've seen that only a few times in my life, people who just by their very presence make everybody feel special. He is that kind of person. And that story, that was an interview we did in his movie theater, which was in the inner city. He had a lot of inner city programs, and he had a lot of inner city businesses. He had his own movie theaters. And we watched his life on a giant screen. It's on YouTube, folks, if people want to see it, Roy Fireson, Magic Johnson. And I'm not plugging me. I'm just telling you the story. So at the end, he started to sob because he realized that his whole life, all he wanted to do was bring success to his community as much as he did for himself. And I think that was an amazing moment. I really loved that.
The Bill Walton interview right after the death of his father.
Oh, boy. Wow. Okay.
Take a listen.
And on the day that my dad passed, I got on my bike.
What was it like?
I got on my bike and I rode to all the places, all the homes, and all the schools and the churches, the gyms.
And what were you left with?
I was left with everything. I was left with the greatest life that a son could ever have.
Boy, for a guy who stuttered for most of his life up until 19 or 20, he's made up for lost time. And what an eloquent interview he was for you.
Well, I get accused. And by the way, I have a sense of humor about it, you know, from Jerry Maguire, that, quote, making them cry. People always say, Roy makes them cry. I never made a single guest cry. By the way, over the 5,000, we had about 20. You do the math. That's less than 1% of 1%. But I never made anybody cry. I think what I did is I helped bring emotions that they wanted to articulate to the surface. And Bill, and this is another interview people want to see on the YouTube, which it was so touching because he's known as kind of this hippie and this goofy guy. I'll say this about Bill Walton, who remains a very close friend of mine. He could be the finest person I've ever met in my life. And I'm not talking about the smartest or the most accomplished or this or that. He's not Warren Buffett. But he's a kind-hearted human being. He's a good person. He's a person who sees the big picture. He appreciates his friends. I don't know that I could say something about another person that would be more important than that. He cares as much for people who love him than he loves himself. And I would also remark this, that in terms of his sense of detail, he always is aware and remembers every little aspect of his life, and he does it day to day. And he's done it for much of the last 20 years in utter pain. He's had a lot of pain with his back and his lower body. At one point, he even almost considered suicide. It was so much pain. But he endured that terrible period in his life. He's just one of the finest, most wonderful people I've ever met in my life.
We're talking with 7-time Emmy Award winner Roy Firestone on the Hollywood Casino Press Box on the all-new 590 The Fan. All right, let's go with some more rapid-fire questions here.
Sure.
A little music in the background. You're in an airport, and you have 2 hours to do nothing but talk to somebody from the sports world. Who do you want to spend 2 hours with?
Could they be living or dead, or
yes,
they have to be alive?
Either one.
I would have to say Jackie Robinson. I'd love to hear what... I never got a chance to meet him. I wanted to meet him. I thought he was a warrior as a human being, but I also heard he was very funny. People don't know that. He was a serious man, but he had a lot of humor to him. And his wife, Rachel, who was on my show several times, said, Jackie would have loved you. And I said, you know, was he a martyr? And she said, no, my husband wasn't a martyr. He was a man. I just thought that was a great line.
Single most disappointing interview. The guy who would not open up at all, and you thought, boy, this was a waste of time.
Well, I won't get political. I promise you I will not. But I have to say it has to be Donald Trump. But I'm just going to end it there. I don't want to go into details. I want to be respectful of people who don't agree with me about him. So I'll leave it that. I was deeply disappointed and, quite frankly, slightly offended. But I don't want to go into it. I wish people to be well in their lives. And I wish our president to do well in our lives, too. I'll leave it there.
All right, really catching you off guard. How about a conversation? And people who don't know Roy real well know he's also a stand-up comic, great impersonator. How about a conversation between Harry Carey and Howard Cosell?
Do you want me to do it for you?
Yes, please.
All right, well, I'm only going to give you a few seconds because I'm not prepared for this.
All right, I'm sorry.
Hello again, everybody. We have a circus. One of the great guys of all time, Howard Cosell. He's got a big bow. We all know that. But you know what? He's funny. And I enjoy talking to him. How you doing, Howard?
All right, I'm fine, Harry. The point of fact is this. The St. Louis Cardinals miss you with great regularity. You went to Chicago, a voice of the Chicago White Sox, and later the Cubs. But St. Louis is still the place where you cut your teeth.
Thank you very much, Howard. You're a great guy and a bum man.
That is amazing. Oh, that is awesome. You're getting a standing ovation in the studio right now. All right. Who turned you down? The one person you tried and never got to sit down.
Oh, that one's easy. That's Joe DiMaggio. Joe came up to me in New Orleans one time at the Super Bowl, walked up to me, says, Mr. Firestone. I said, yes, how are you, Mr. DiMaggio? I'm quite fine. I saw the program you had with Dominic. That was his brother, Dom DiMaggio, by the way, who was on the show. I saw the show with Dominic, and I just want you to know that I thoroughly enjoyed it, and you do a marvelous job. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Before I get started to ask the question, you know, I start to go, would you? He goes, and I have no desire to appear on your program.
I got to tell you, you do a good Joe DiMaggio, too. That's good.
That's how we talked.
What sports media member, when you see him or her on television, just always impresses you? You never disappoint.
Well, nah, that's also an easy one. It's a slam dunk. It's Bob Costas. Bob is my friend for 35 years. He's got the right tone. He's got the intelligence. He's got this rapid sense of humor. Just lightning fast. A good human being who gets the big picture of sports. Best interviewer probably I've known in my generation. People ask me who's my favorite interviewer. It's Bob. And also a decent, kind-hearted human being. It's a slam dunk. He's my favorite guy. When I see him on TV, I say, that's the way I wish I could do it. Right there.
Give me a couple of thoughts on these programs as a whole. First Take, Undisputed, Around the Horn.
Well, you know, Frank, here's the thing. I want to be candid with you, and I want to be, open with you. But I don't want to sound sour or judging other people. Let me put it to you this way. First of all, I love Pardon the Interruption. I'll say that. I think that show is great. It's been great for years. Those two, Mike and Tony, are fabulous at what they do. But the other shows, to me, I'm not going to disparage them. I just don't believe in that. I'm not going to sit there and put it. It's maybe not my cup of tea. That's about as good as I can say it. But I do believe that Pardon the Interruption is a great show. I'm not a fan of shout shows, people screaming across the table. There's always a woman. You ever notice how there's like a woman referee in the middle? It's usually a very good-looking woman who gets very little to say, and she sits there while two people argue back and forth. I never understood the format. And by the way, it's all over the place. It's not just in sports. It's in politics. It's in every kind of thing in media now. It's the same thing over and over again. For me, I'm speaking only for me. It's not my cup of tea.
How would you like to be remembered when you close things up, say, in 10 years from now?
Let me start with, I hope we have 10 years. I'd love to be remembered as a good father, a great a person who cared about other people. I have had a charity in Los Angeles, for example. I'm going to plug it for a second because it does good, not about me, but it's about the good it does. For 23 years, for inner city kids, sports and recreation and mentoring, we've raised $4 million. I'm very, very proud of that. I want to be remembered for something like that. I want to be somebody who people understood, who even though they called me the guy who makes them cry, could make them laugh, too. I love performing. I love doing musical stuff. I love performing in St. Louis. I did a show about a year and a half there ago. I have friends of family from my son's fiance live in St. Louis, and I love them dearly. I just want people to know that I do the best I can. I'm very, very flawed. Believe me, I look in the mirror and I see it every day, metaphorically and literally. I just enjoy life, and I want people to say, boy, he got the most out of his talents, whatever that might be, and enjoyed life and was kind to people.
And a final thought, you have an ode to St. Louis to finish us up.
Well, you have to give me a minute here, Frank. I hope that'll be okay.
It's
a little long, but I wrote this up when I did my speech for St. Louis, and I'm going to give it to you real fast.
Sure.
Ready?
Go ahead.
Here we go. Sitting by the Mississippi, St. Louis town was always hip since long before the Gateway Arch was built. From Daniel Boone to Jimmy Connors, Scotia folks have brought us honors, making news and living to the hilt. Now, you might not be quite aware how many stars have come from there. The list on Wikipedia is a killer. From the likes of Vincent Price, Big John Goodman had some spice, all the way from Linda Blair to Phyllis Diller. But there's music in this town and musicians of renown like Chuck Berry and Scott Joplin long ago, Ike and Tina like no others, Ronald Isley and the Brothers, not to mention cool Miles Davis. Now he could blow. But the real St. Louis story, it's a different category. It's the world of sports, and it really has no peer. We got Cardinals, we got Blues, and they really hate to lose. And, of course, the mighty Rams, well, they're not here. Heroes from a bygone era, from Lou Brock to Yogi Berra, from St. Louis to the Baseball Hall of Fame. They had talents quite unusual. So did Ozzie Smith and Stan Musial, making major contributions to the game. Don't forget old Elston Howard, who was certainly not a coward as the first black player ever for the Yanks. And another bunch of guys that may come as no surprise, the announcers, and they deserve our thanks. Going back so long ago, old Jack Buck and his son Joe brought us all the action for the Cards. Legends such as Harry Carey, Joe Gargiola, ain't that scary. Know that all St. Louis sends you its regards. NBC just might have lost us if we hadn't hired Bob Costas, guiding through 9 Olympic years. And that reminds me, Lord have mercy, we got Jackie Joyner Kersee 6 Olympic medals with the cheers. Did we mention boxing? Well, for sure there's no outboxing these 4 fellas, the St. Louis bred and raised. Archie Moore and Sonny Liston, Leon Spinks, the human piston, and his brother Michael, they're champions to be praised. Let's keep the good times rolling with Dick Weber, King of Bowling, and our great football great Dan Dirdorf makes the list. I could keep the names a-flowing, but the way things are going, well, I believe you folks by now have got the gist.
Wow, unbelievable! So you did that speech before the cancer speech you did a few years back?
Yes, that was indeed great. Yeah.
And
we had visuals flying. We had visuals flying behind me as I was doing sort of a rap about St. Louis. There it is.
Honored to have you on the program, sir. Thank you so much for your time, Roy.
Frank, congratulations on all the great years. Continued success.